She believes woman accomplishes herself totally through it, but under the condition that it is freely assumed and sincerely desired. The young woman must be in a psychological, moral, and material situation that allows her to bear the responsibility. If not, the consequences will be disastrous. In particular, it is criminal to advise having a child as a remedy for melancholia or neuroses. It causes unhappiness for mother and child. Only a balanced, healthy woman, conscious of her responsibilities, is capable of becoming a good mother. I have said that the curse weighing on marriage is that individuals too often join together in their weakness and not in their strength, that each one asks of the other rather than finding pleasure in giving. It is an even more deceptive lure to dream of attaining through a child a plenitude, warmth, and value one is incapable of creating oneself. It can bring joy only to the woman capable of disinterestedly wanting the happiness of another, to the woman who seeks to transcend her own existence without any reward for her. To be sure, a child is an undertaking one can validly aspire to, but like any other undertaking, it does not represent a justification in itself, and it must be desired for itself, not for hypothetical benefits. Stekel quite rightly says, "Children are not substitutes for one's disappointed love. They are not substitutes for one's thwarted ideal in life. Children are not mere material to fill out an empty existence. Children are a responsibility and an opportunity. Children are the loftiest blossoms upon the tree of untrammeled love. They are neither playthings nor tools for the fulfillment of parental needs or ungratified ambitions. Children are obligations. They should be brought up so as to become happy human beings." Such an obligation is not at all natural. Nature could never dictate a moral choice. This implies an engagement. To have a child is to take on a commitment. If the mother shrinks from it, she commits an offense against human existence, against a freedom. But no one can impose it on her. The relation of parents to children, like that of spouses, must be freely chosen. And it is not even true that the child is a privileged accomplishment for a woman. It is often said that a woman is coquettish, or amorous, or lesbian, or ambitious as a result of being childless. Her sexual life, her goals, and the values she pursues are deemed to be substitutes for the child. In fact, from the beginning, there is indetermination. One can just as well say that lacking love, an occupation, or the power to satisfy her homosexual tendencies, a woman wants to have a child. A social and artificial morality hides behind this pseudo-naturalism. That the child is the ultimate end for woman is an affirmation worthy of an advertising slogan. The second preconceived idea immediately following the first is that the child is sure to find happiness in his mother's arms. There is no such thing as an unnatural mother, since maternal love has nothing natural about it. But precisely because of that, there are bad mothers. And one of the great truths that psychoanalysis has proclaimed is the danger normal parents constitute for a child. The complexes, obsessions, and neuroses adults suffer from have their roots in their family past. Parents who have their own conflicts, quarrels, and dramas are the least desirable company for children. Deeply marked by the paternal household, they approach their own children through complexes and frustrations, and this chain of misery perpetuates itself indefinitely. In particular, maternal sadomasochism creates guilt feelings for the daughter that will express themselves in sadomasochistic behavior toward her own children without end. There is extravagant bad faith in the conflation of contempt for women and respect shown for mothers. It is a criminal paradox to deny women all public activity, to close masculine careers to them, to proclaim them incapable in all domains, and to nonetheless entrust to them the most delicate and most serious of all undertakings, the formation of a human being. There are many women who, out of custom and tradition, are still refused education, culture, responsibilities, and activities that are the privileges of men, and in whose arms, nevertheless, babies are placed without scruple, as in earlier life they were consoled for their inferiority to boys with dolls. They are deprived of living their lives. As compensation, they are allowed to play with flesh and blood toys. A woman would have to be perfectly happy or a saint to resist the temptation of abusing her rights. Montesquieu was perhaps right when he said it would be better to entrust women with the government of state than with a family. For as soon as she is given the opportunity, woman is as reasonable and efficient as man. It is in abstract thought, in concerted action, that she most easily rises above her sex. It is far more difficult in this day and age to free herself from her feminine past, to find an emotional balance that nothing in her situation favors. Man is also much more balanced and rational in his work than at home. He calculates with mathematical precision. He lets himself go with his wife, becoming illogical, a liar, capricious. Likewise, she lets herself go with her child. And this self-indulgence is more dangerous because she can better defend herself against her husband than the child can defend himself against her. It would obviously be better for the child if his mother were a complete person and not a mutilated one. A woman who finds in her work and her relations with the group a self-accomplishment she could not attain through his tyranny. And it would be preferable also for the child to be left infinitely less to his parents than he is now, that his studies and amusements take place with other children under the control of adults whose links with him are only impersonal and dispassionate. Even in cases where the child is a treasure within a happy or at least balanced life, he cannot be the full extent of his mother's horizons. He does not wrest her from her imminence. She shapes his flesh. She supports him. She cares for him. She can do no more than create a situation that solely the child's freedom can transcend. When she invests in his future, it is again by proxy that she transcends herself through the universe and time. That is, once again, she dooms herself to dependency. Not only his ingratitude, but the failure of her son will refute all of her hopes. As in marriage or love, she puts the care of justifying her life in the hands of another, whereas the only authentic behavior is to assume it freely herself. Woman's inferiority, as we have seen, originally came from the fact that she was restricted to repeating life, while man invented reasons for living, in his eyes more essential than the pure facticity of existence. Confining woman to motherhood is the perpetuation of this situation. But today, she demands participation in the movement by which humanity ceaselessly tries to find justification by surpassing itself. She can only consent to give life if life has meaning. She cannot try to be a mother without playing a role in economic, political, or social life. It is not the same thing to produce cannon fodder, slaves, victims, as to give birth to free men. In a properly organized society where the child would in great part be taken charge of by the group, where the mother would be cared for and helped, motherhood would absolutely not be incompatible with women's work. On the contrary, a woman who works, farmer, chemist, or writer, has the easiest pregnancy because she is not centered on her own person. It is the woman who has the richest personal life who will give the most to her child and who will ask for the least. She who acquires real human values through effort and struggle will be the most fit to bring up children. If too often today a woman has a hard time reconciling the interests of her children with a profession that demands long hours away from home and all her strength, it is because, on the one hand, woman's work is still too often a kind of slavery. On the other hand, no effort has been made to ensure children's health, care, and education outside the home. This is social neglect, but it is a sophism to justify it by pretending that a law was written in heaven or in the bowels of the earth that requires that the mother and child belong to each other exclusively. This mutual belonging in reality only constitutes a double and harmful oppression. It is a mystification to maintain that woman becomes man's equal through motherhood. Psychoanalysts have tried hard to prove that the child provides the equivalent of the penis for her. But enviable as this attribute may be, no one believes that possessing one can justify an existence or that such possession can be a supreme end in itself. There has been an enormous amount of talk about the sacred rights of women, but being a mother is not how women gained the right to vote. The unwed mother is still scorned. It is only in marriage that the mother is glorified. In other words, as long as she is subordinate to the husband. As long as he is the economic head of the family, even though it is she who cares for the children, they depend far more on him than on her. This is why, as has been seen, the mother's relationship with her children is deeply influenced by the one she maintains with her husband. So conjugal relations, homemaking, and motherhood form a whole in which all the parts are determinant. Tenderly united to her husband, the wife can cheerfully carry out the duties of the home. Happy with her children, she will be understanding of her husband. But this harmony is not easy to attain, for the different functions assigned to the wife conflict with each other. Women's magazines amply advise the housewife on the art of maintaining her sexual attraction while doing the dishes, of remaining elegant throughout pregnancy, of reconciling flirtation, motherhood, and economy. But if she conscientiously follows their advice, she will soon be overwhelmed and disfigured by care. It is very difficult to remain desirable with chapped hands and a body deformed by pregnancies. This is why a woman in love often feels resentment of the children who ruin her seduction and deprive her of her husband's caresses. If she is, by contrast, deeply maternal, she is jealous of the man who also claims the children as his. But then, the perfect homemaker, as has been seen, contradicts the movement of life. The child is the enemy of waxed floors. Maternal love is often lost in the reprimands and outbursts that underlie the concern for a well-kept home. It is not surprising that the woman torn between these contradictions often spends her day in a state of nervousness and bitterness. She always loses on some level, and her gains are precarious. They do not count as any sure success. She can never save herself by her work alone. It keeps her occupied, but does not constitute her justification. Her justification rests on outside freedoms. The wife, shut up in her home, cannot establish her existence on her own. She does not have the means to affirm herself in her singularity, and this singularity is consequently not acknowledged. For Arabs or Indians, and in many rural populations, a wife is only a female servant appreciated according to the work she provides, and who is replaced without regret if she disappears. In modern civilization, she is more or less individualized in her husband's eyes, but unless she completely renounces herself, swallowed up like Natasha in a passionate and tyrannical devotion to her family, she suffers from being reduced to pure generality. She is the mistress of the house, the wife, the unique and indistinct mother. Natasha delights in this supreme self-effacement, and in rejecting all confrontation, she negates others. But the modern Western woman, by contrast, wants to be noticed by others as this mistress of the house, this wife, this mother, this woman. Herein lies the satisfaction she will seek in her social life. Chapter 7. Social Life. The family is not a closed community. Notwithstanding its separateness, it establishes relations with other social units. The home is not only an interior in which the couple is confined. It is also the expression of its living standard, its wealth, its tastes. It must be exhibited for others to see. It is essentially the woman who will organize this social life. The man is connected to the community as producer and citizen by ties of an organic solidarity based on the division of labor. The couple is a social person, defined by the family, class, milieu, and race to which it belongs, attached by ties of mechanical solidarity to groups socially similar to themselves. The woman is the one most likely to embody this most purely. The husband's professional relations often do not reflect his social level, while the wife, who does not have the obligations brought about by work, can limit herself to the company of her peers. Besides, she has the leisure through her visits and receptions to promote these relations, useless in practice, and that, of course, matter only in categories of people wanting to hold their rank in the social hierarchy. That is, who consider themselves superior to certain others. She delights in showing off her home and even herself, which her husband and children do not see because they have a vested interest in them. Her social duty, which is to represent, will become part of the pleasure she has in showing herself to others. First, she has to represent herself. At home, going about her occupations, she merely dresses. To go out, to entertain, she dresses up. Dressing has a twofold significance. It is meant to show the woman's social standing, her standard of living, her wealth, the social class she belongs to. But at the same time, it concretizes feminine narcissism. It is her uniform and her attire. The woman who suffers from not doing anything thinks she is expressing her being through her dress. Beauty treatments and dressing are kinds of work that allow her to appropriate her person as she appropriates her home through housework. She thus believes that she is choosing and recreating her own self. And social customs encourage her to alienate herself in her image. Like his body, a man's clothes must convey his transcendence and not attract attention. For him, neither elegance nor beauty constitutes him as object. Thus, he does not usually consider his appearance a reflection of his being. Note, refer to Volume 1. Homosexuals are an exception, as they specifically grasp themselves as sexual objects. Dandies also, who must be studied separately. Today, in particular, the zoot suitism of the American blacks, who dress in light-colored, noticeable suits, is explained with very complex reasons. By contrast, society even requires woman to make herself an erotic object. The goal of the fashion to which she is in thrall is not to reveal her as an autonomous individual, but on the contrary, to cut her from her transcendence so as to offer her as a prey to male desires. Fashion does not serve to fulfill her projects, but on the contrary, to thwart them. A skirt is less convenient than trousers, and high-heeled shoes impede walking. The least practical dresses and high heels, the most fragile hats and stockings, are the most elegant. Whether the outfit disguises, deforms, or molds the body, in any case, it delivers it to view. This explains why dressing is an enchanting game for the little girl who wants to look at herself. Later, her child's autonomy rises up against the constraints of light-colored muslin and patent leather shoes. At the awkward age, she is torn between the desire and the refusal to show herself off. Once she has accepted her vocation as sex object, she enjoys adorning herself. As we have said, by adorning herself, woman is akin to nature, while attesting to nature's need for artifice. She becomes flower and jewel for man and for herself as well. Note, refer to Volume 1, Part 3, Myths, Chapter 1. Before giving him rippling water or the soft warmth of furs, she takes them for herself. More intimately than her knickknacks, rugs, cushions, and bouquets, she prizes feathers, pearls, brocade, and silks that she mingles with her flesh. Their shimmer and their gentle contact compensate for the harshness of the erotic universe that is her lot. The more her sensuality is unsatiated, the more importance she gives to it. If many lesbians dress in a masculine way, it is not only out of imitation of males and defiance of society. They do not need the caresses of velvet and satin because they grasp such passive qualities on a feminine body. Note, Sandor, whose case Croft Abing detailed, adored well-dressed women, but did not dress up. The woman given to the harsh masculine embrace, even if she savors it, and even more if she gets no pleasure from it, can embrace no carnal prey other than her own body. She perfumes it to change it into a flower, and the shine of the diamonds she puts around her neck is no different from that of her skin. In order to possess them, she identifies with all the riches of the world. She covets not only sensual treasures, but sometimes also sentimental values and ideals. This jewel is a souvenir. That one is a symbol. Some women make themselves bouquets, aviaries. Others are museums and still others hieroglyphs. Georgette Leblanc tells us in her memoirs, evoking her youth, "I was always dressed like a painting. I walked around in Van Eyck in an allegory of Rubens or in the Virgin of Memling. I still see myself crossing a street in Brussels one winter day in a dress of amethyst velvet embellished with old silver binding taken from some tunic. Dragging insouciantly my long train behind me, I was conscientiously sweeping the pavement. My folly of yellow fur framed my blonde hair, but the most unusual thing was the diamond placed on the frontlet of my forehead. Why all this? Simply because it pleased me, and so I thought I was living outside of all convention. The more I was laughed at as I went by, the more extravagant my burlesque conventions. I would have been ashamed to change anything in my appearance just because I was being mocked. That would have seemed to me to be a degrading capitulation. At home, it was something else again. The angels of Gozzoli, Fra Angelico, Burne Jones, and Watts were my models. I was always attired in azure and aurora, my flowing dresses spread out in manifold trains around me." The best examples of this magical appropriation of the universe are found in mental institutions. A woman who does not control her love for precious objects and symbols forgets her own appearance and risks dressing outlandishly. The very little girl thus sees in dressing a disguise that changes her into a fairy, a queen, a flower. She thinks she is beautiful as soon as she is laden with garlands and ribbons, because she identifies with these flashy clothes. Charmed by the color of a piece of material, the naive young girl does not notice the wan complexion it gives her. One also finds this excessive bad taste in women artists or intellectuals more fascinated by the outside world than conscious of their own appearance. Infatuated by these old materials and antique jewels, they delight in conjuring up China or the Middle Ages, and give the mirror no more than a cursory or passing glance. It is sometimes surprising to see the strange get-ups elderly women like. Tiaras, lace, bright dresses, and extravagant necklaces unfortunately draw attention to their ravaged features. Now that they have given up seduction, clothes often become once again a gratuitous game for them, as in their childhood. An elegant woman, by contrast, can seek sensual or aesthetic pleasures in her clothes if need be, but she must reconcile them in harmony with her image. The color of her dress will flatter her complexion. The cut will emphasize or improve her figure. Arrayed, she complacently cherishes her adorned self and not the objects that adorn her. Dressing is not only adornment. It expresses, as we have said, woman's social situation. Only the prostitute, whose function is exclusively that of a sex object, displays herself exclusively in this light. In the past, it was her saffron hair and the flowers that dotted her dress. Today, it is her high heels, skimpy satin, harsh makeup, and heavy perfume that are the signature of her profession. Any other woman is criticized for dressing like a strumpet. Her erotic qualities are integrated into social life and can only appear in this toned-down form. But it must be emphasized that decency does not mean dressing with strict modesty. A woman who teases male desire too blatantly is considered vulgar. But a woman who is seen to repudiate this is disreputable as well. She is seen as wanting to look like a man. She's a lesbian, or to single herself out, she's an eccentric, refusing her role as object, she defies society. She's an anarchist. If she simply does not want to be noticed, she must still conserve her femininity. Custom dictates the compromise between exhibitionism and modesty. Sometimes it is the neckline and sometimes the ankle that the virtuous woman must hide. Sometimes the young girl has the right to highlight her charms so as to attract suitors, while the married woman gives up all adornment. Such is the usage in many peasant civilizations. Sometimes young girls have to dress in flowing clothes of baby colors and modest cut, while their elders are allowed tight-fitting dresses, heavy material, rich hues, and daring cuts. On a 16-year-old, black stands out because the rule at that age is not to wear it. Note, in a film set last century, and a rather stupid one, Betty Davis created a scandal by wearing a red dress to the ball, whereas white was de rigueur until marriage. Her act was considered a rebellion against the established order. One must, of course, conform to these laws, but in any case, and even in the most austere circles, woman's sexual attributes will be emphasized. The pastor's wife curls her hair, wears some makeup, is discreetly fashion-conscious, indicating through the attention to her physical charm that she accepts her female role. This integration of eroticism into social life is particularly obvious in the evening gown. To mark a social gathering, that is, luxury and waste, these dresses must be costly and delicate. They must be as uncomfortable as possible. Skirts are long and so wide or so complicated that they impede walking. Under the jewels, ruffles, sequins, flowers, feathers, and false hair, woman is changed into a flesh doll. Even this flesh is exposed. Just as flowers bloom gratuitously, the woman displays her shoulders, back, bosom. Except in orgies, the man must not indicate that he covets her. He only has the right to looks and the embraces of the dance. But he can take delight in being the king of a world of such tender treasures. From one man to another, the festivity takes on the appearance of a potlatch. Each of them gives the vision of this body that is his property to all the others as a gift. In her evening dress, the woman is disguised as woman for all the male's pleasure and the pride of her owner. This social significance of the toilette allows woman to express her attitude to society by the way she dresses. Subject to the established order, she confers on herself a discreet and tasteful personality. Many nuances are possible. She will make herself fragile, childlike, mysterious, candid, austere, gay, poised, a little daring, self-effacing, as she chooses. Or, on the contrary, she will affirm her rejection of conventions by her originality. It is striking that in many novels the liberated woman distinguishes herself by an audacity in dressing that emphasizes her character as sex object, and thus of dependence. So, in Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence, the young divorced woman with an adventuresome past and a bold heart is first presented with a plunging décolletage. The whiff of scandal she provokes becomes the tangible reflection of her scorn for conformity. Thus, the young girl will enjoy dressing as a woman, the older woman as a little girl, the courtesan as a sophisticated woman of the world, and the woman of the world as a vamp. Even if every woman dresses according to her status, there is still play in it. Artifice, like art, is situated in the imagination. Not only do girdle, bra, hair dyes, and makeup disguise body and face, but as soon as she is dressed up, the least sophisticated woman is not concerned with perception. She is like a painting, a statue, like an actor on stage, an analogon through which is suggested an absent subject who is her character, but is not she. It is this confusion with an unreal object, necessary, perfect, like a hero in a novel, like a portrait or a bust, that flatters her. She strives to alienate herself in it, and so to appear frozen, justified to herself. Page by page, we see Marie Bashkirtseff in a Chrysanthème, intimate writings, endlessly remaking her image. She does not spare us any of her dresses. For each new outfit, she believes she is an other, and she adores herself anew. I took one of Mama's great shawls, I made a slit for my head, and I sewed up the two sides. This shawl that falls in classic folds gives me an oriental, biblical, strange look. I go to the La Ferrière's, and in just 3 hours, Caroline makes me a dress in which I look as if I'm enveloped in a cloud. This is a piece of English crepe that she drapes over me, making me thin, elegant, and long. Enveloped in a warm wool dress, hanging in harmonious folds, a character out of Lefebvre who knows so well how to draw these lithe and young bodies in modest fabrics. This refrain is repeated day after day. I was charming in black. In gray, I was charming. I was in white, charming. Madame de Noailles, who also accorded much importance to her dress, speaks sadly in her memoirs of the crisis of a failed dress. I loved the vividness of the colors, their daring contrast. A dress seemed like a landscape, the beginning of adventure. Just as I was putting on the dress made by unsure hands, I suffered from all the defects I saw. If the toilette has so much importance for many women, it is because they are under the illusion that it provides them both with the world and with their own self. A German novel, The Artificial Silk Girl, note by Irmgard Koyne, tells the story of a poor girl's passion for a vair coat. Sensually, she loved the caressing warmth of it, the furry tenderness. In precious skins, it is her transfigured self she cherishes. She finally possesses the beauty of the world she had never embraced, and the radiant destiny that had never been hers. And then I saw a coat hanging from a hook, a fur so soft, so smooth, so tender, so gray, so shy. I felt like kissing it, I loved it so much. It looked like consolation and All Saints' Day and total safety, like the sky. It was genuine vair. Silently, I took off my raincoat and put on the vair. This fur was like a diamond on my skin that loved it, and what one loves, one doesn't give it back once one has it. Inside, a Moroccan crepe lining, pure silk with hand embroidery. The coat enveloped me and spoke more than I to Hubert's heart. I am so elegant in this fur. It is like the rare man who would make me precious through his love for me. This coat wants me, and I want it. We have each other. As woman is an object, it is obvious that how she is adorned and dressed affects her intrinsic value. It is not pure frivolousness for her to attach so much importance to silk stockings, gloves, and a hat. Keeping her rank is an imperious obligation. In America, a great part of the working woman's budget is devoted to beauty care and clothes. In France, this expense is lighter. Nevertheless, a woman is all the more respected if she presents well. The more she needs to find work, the more useful it is to look well off. Elegance is a weapon, a sign, a banner of respect, a letter of recommendation. It is a servitude. The values it confers have a price. They sometimes have such a high price that a detective catches a socialite or an actress shoplifting perfumes, silk stockings, or underwear. Many women prostitute themselves or get help in order to keep themselves well-dressed. It is their clothes that determine their need for money. Being well-dressed also requires time and care. It is a chore that is sometimes a source of positive joy. In this area, there is also the discovery of hidden treasures, trades, ruses, arrangements, and invention. A clever woman can even be creative. Showroom days, especially the sales, are frenetic adventures. A new dress is a celebration in itself. Makeup and hair are substitutes for a work of art. Today, more than before, woman knows the joys of shaping her body by sports, gymnastics, swimming, massage, and diets. Note, according to recent studies, however, It seems that women's gymnasiums in France are almost empty. It was especially between 1920 and 1940 that French women indulged in physical culture. Household problems weigh too heavy on them at this time. She decides on her weight, her figure, and her complexion. Modern beauty treatments allow her to combine beauty and activity. She has the right to toned muscles. She refuses to put on weight. In physical culture, she affirms herself as subject. This gives her a kind of liberation from her contingent flesh. But this liberation easily lapses back into dependence. The Hollywood star triumphs over nature, but she finds herself a passive object in the producer's hands. Next to these victories in which woman rightly takes delight, taking care of one's appearance implies, like household tasks, a fight against time, because her body, too, is an object eroded by time. Colette Audry describes this fight, comparable to the one the housewife engages against dust. Already, it was no longer the compact flesh of youth. Along her arms and thighs, the pattern of her muscles showed through a layer of fat and slightly flabby skin. Upset, she once again changed her schedule. Her day would begin with half an hour of gymnastics, and in the evening, before getting into bed, a quarter of an hour of massage. She took to reading medical books and fashion magazines, to watching her waistline. She prepared fruit juices, took a laxative from time to time, and did the dishes with rubber gloves. Her two concerns, rejuvenating her body and refurbishing her home, finally became one, so that one day she would reach a kind of steadiness, a kind of dead center. The world would be as if stopped, suspended outside of aging and decay. At the swimming pool, she now took serious lessons to improve her style, and the beauty magazines kept her breathless with infinitely renewed recipes. Ginger Rogers confides to us, "I brush my hair 100 strokes every morning. It takes exactly 2.5 minutes, and I have silky hair." How to get thinner ankles? Stand on your toes every day, 30 times in a row, without putting your heels down. This exercise only takes a minute. What is a minute in a day? Another time, it is an oil bath for nails, lemon paste for hands, crushed strawberries on cheeks. Note, playing a losing game. Routine, here again, turns beauty care and wardrobe maintenance into chores. The horror of degradation that all living change involves in some cold or frustrated women arouses a horror of life itself. They seek to preserve themselves as others preserve furniture or jam. This negative stubbornness makes them enemies of their own existence and hostile to others. Good meals damage their figures. Wine spoils their complexions. Smiling too much gives you wrinkles. The sun hurts the skin. Rest makes you lethargic. Work wears you out. Love gives you circles under your eyes. Kisses make your cheeks red. Caresses deform your breasts. Embraces shrivel the flesh. Pregnancies disfigure your face and body. You know how young mothers angrily push away the child marveling at their ball gown. "Don't touch me. Your hands are all sticky. You're going to get me dirty." The appearance conscious rejects her husband's or lover's ardor with the same rebuffs. Just as one covers furniture with loose covers, she would like to withdraw from men, the world, time. But none of these precautions prevents the appearance of gray hair and crow's feet. Starting from youth, woman knows this destiny is inevitable, and regardless of her vigilance, she is a victim of accidents. A drop of wine falls on her dress, a cigarette burns it, and so the creature of luxury and parties who smilingly struts about the living room disappears. She turns into the serious and hard housewife. Suddenly, one discovers that her toilette was not a bouquet of flowers, fireworks, a gratuitous and perishable splendor destined to generously light up an instant. It is an asset, capital, an investment. It demands sacrifices. Its loss is an irreparable disaster. Stains, holes, dresses that are failures, and ruined perms are far more serious catastrophes than a burned roast or a broken vase. Because the coquettish woman is not only alienated in things, she wants to be a thing. And without an intermediary, she feels insecure in the world. The relations she maintains with her dressmaker and milliner, her impatience, her demands, are manifestations of her seriousness and insecurity. A successful dress creates in her the character of her dreams, but in a soiled, ruined outfit, she feels demeaned. Marie Bashkirtseff writes, "My mood, my manners, the expression on my face, everything depended on my dress. And then, either you have to go around naked, or you have to dress according to your body, taste, and character. When they are not right, I feel gauche, common, and therefore humiliated. What happens to the mood and mind? They think about clothes, and so one becomes stupid, boring, and one does not know what to do with oneself." Many women prefer to miss a party than go badly dressed, even if they are not going to be noticed. However, although some women affirm, "I dress for myself only," we have seen that even in narcissism, the gaze of the other is involved. Only in asylums do the fashion conscious stubbornly keep their faith in absent gazes. Normally, they demand witnesses. After 10 years of marriage, Sophia Tolstoy writes, "I want people to admire me and say how pretty I am, and I want Liova to see and hear them too. I hate people who tell me I am beautiful. I never believed them. What would be the point of it? My darling little Petya loves his old nanny just as much as he would love a great beauty. I am having my hair curled today and have been happily imagining how nice it will look, even though nobody will see me and it is quite unnecessary. I adore ribbons, and I would like a new leather belt. And now I have written this, I feel like crying." Husbands do not perform this role well. Here again, the husband's demands are duplicitous. If his wife is too attractive, he becomes jealous. But every husband is more or less King Kandali's. He wants his wife to make him proud, for her to be elegant, pretty, or at least presentable. If not, he will humorously tell her these words of Per Ubu: "You are quite ugly today. Is it because we are expecting company?" In marriage, as we have seen, erotic and social values are not very compatible. Such antagonism is reflected in this situation. The wife who accentuates her sexual attraction is considered vulgar in her husband's eyes. He criticizes this boldness that would seduce him in an unknown woman, and this criticism kills all desire for her. If his wife dresses decently, he approves, but coldly. He does not find her attractive and vaguely reproaches her for it. Because of that, he rarely looks at her on his own account. He inspects her through the eyes of others. What will they say about her? He does not see clearly because he projects his spousal point of view onto others. Nothing is more irritating for a woman than to see him appreciate in another the dresses or way of dressing he criticizes in her. Naturally, of course, he is too close to her to see her. Her face is immutable for him. Nor does he notice her outfits or hairstyle. Even a husband in love or an infatuated lover is often indifferent to a woman's clothes. If they love her ardently in her nudity, the most attractive adornments merely disguise her, and they will cherish her whether badly dressed, tired, or dazzling. If they no longer love her, the most flattering dresses will be of no avail. Clothes can be an instrument of conquest, but not a weapon of defense. Their art is to create mirages. They offer the viewer an imaginary object. In the erotic embrace and in daily relations, mirages fade. Conjugal feelings like physical love exist in the realm of reality. Women do not dress for the loved man. Dorothy Parker, in one of her short stories, describes a young woman who, waiting impatiently for her husband, who is on leave, decides to make herself beautiful to welcome him. She bought a new dress, black. He liked black dresses. Simple. He liked plain dresses. And so expensive that she would not think of its price. "Do you like my dress?" "Oh, yes," he said. "I always liked that dress on you." It was as if she turned to wood. This dress she said, enunciating with insulting distinctness, is brand new. I have never had it on before in my life. In case you are interested, I bought it especially for this occasion. I'm sorry, honey, he said. Oh, sure, now I see it's not the other one at all. I think it's great. I like you in black. At moments like this, she said, I almost wish I were in it for another reason. Note, The Lovely Eva. The real title of the short story is The Lovely Leave. Translation. It is often said that women dress to arouse jealousy in other women. This jealousy is really a clear sign of success. But this is not its only aim. Through envious or admiring approbation, woman seeks an absolute affirmation of her beauty, her elegance, her taste, of herself. She dresses to display herself. She displays herself to make herself be. She thus submits herself to a painful dependence. The housewife's devotion is useful even if it is not recognized. The effort of the fashion-conscious woman is in vain unless consciousness is involved. She is looking for a definitive valorization of herself. It is this attempt at the absolute that makes her quest so exhausting. Criticized by only one voice, this hat is not beautiful. She is flattered by a compliment, but a contradiction demolishes her. And as the absolute only manifests itself in an indefinite series of appearances, she will never have entirely won. This is why the fashion-conscious woman is sensitive. It is also why some pretty and much admired women can be sadly convinced they are neither beautiful nor elegant, that this supreme approbation of an unknown judge is exactly what is missing. They are aiming for an in itself that is unrealizable. Rare are the gorgeous, stylish women who embody in themselves the laws of elegance, whom no one can fault because they are the ones who define success or failure. As long as their reign endures, they can think of themselves as an exemplary success. What is unfortunate is that this success serves nothing and no one. Clothes immediately imply going out and receptions, and besides, that is their original intent. The woman parades her new outfit from place to place and invites other women to see her reign over her interior. In certain particularly important situations, the husband accompanies her on her calls, but most often she fulfills her social obligations while he is at work. The implacable ennui weighing on these gatherings has been described hundreds of times. It comes from the fact that these women gathered there by social obligations have nothing to say to each other. There is no common interest linking the lawyer's wife to the doctor's, and none between Dr. DuPont's and Dr. Durand's. It is bad taste in a general conversation to talk of one's children's pranks or problems with the help. What is left is discussion of the weather, the latest novel, and a few general ideas borrowed from their husbands. This custom of calling is tending to disappear, but the chore of the call, in various forms, survives in France. American women often replace conversation with bridge, which is an advantage only for women who enjoy this game. However, social life has more attractive forms than carrying out this idle duty of etiquette. Entertaining is not just welcoming others into one's own home. It is changing one's home into an enchanted domain. The social event is both festivity and potlatch. The mistress of the house displays her treasures, silver, table linen, crystal. She dresses the house with flowers, ephemeral and useless. Flowers exemplify the gratuitousness of occasions that mean expenses and luxury. Blooming in vases, doomed to a rapid death, flowers are ceremonial bonfires. Incense and myrrh, libation, sacrifice. The table is laden with fine food, precious wines. It means satisfying the guests' needs. It is a question of inventing gracious gifts that anticipate their desires. The meal becomes a mysterious ceremony. Virginia Woolf emphasizes this aspect in this passage from Mrs. Dalloway. And so there began a soundless and exquisite passing to and fro through swing doors of aproned, white-capped maids, handmaidens not of necessity, but adepts in a mystery or grand deception practiced by hostesses in Mayfair from 1:30 to 2, when, with the wave of a hand, the traffic ceases, and there rises instead this profound delusion in the first place about the food, how it is not paid for, and then that the table spreads itself voluntarily with glass and silver, little mats, saucers of red fruit, films of brown cream masked turbot, in casseroles severed chickens swim, colored, undomestic, the fire burns, and with the wine and the coffee, not paid for, rise jocund visions before musing eyes, gently speculative eyes, eyes to whom life appears musical, mysterious. The woman who presides over these mysteries is proud to feel she is the creator of a perfect moment, the dispenser of happiness and gaiety. She is the one bringing the guests together. She is the one making the event take place. She is the gratuitous source of joy and harmony. This is exactly what Mrs. Dalloway feels. But suppose Peter said to her, "Yes, yes, but your parties, what's the sense of your parties?" All she could say was, and nobody could be expected to understand, "They're an offering. Here was so-and-so in South Kensington, someone up in Bayswater, and somebody else, say, in Mayfair." And she felt quite continuously a sense of their existence. And she felt what a waste. And she felt what a pity. And she felt if only they could be brought together. So she did it. And it was an offering to combine, to create. But to whom? An offering for the sake of offering, perhaps. Anyhow, it was her gift. Nothing else had she of the slightest importance. Anybody could do it. Yet this anybody she did a little admire, couldn't help feeling that she had, anyhow, made this happen. If there is pure generosity in this homage to others, the party is really a party. But social routine quickly changes the potlatch into an institution, the gift into an obligation, and the party hardens into a rite. All the while savoring the dinner out, the invited woman ponders having to return the invitation. She sometimes complains of having been entertained too well. "The exes wanted to impress us," she says bitterly to her husband. "I have been told that during the last war in a little Portuguese city, tea parties had become the most costly of potlatches. At each gathering, the mistress of the house had to serve more varied cakes and in greater number than the previous one. This burden became so heavy that one day all the women decided together not to serve anything anymore with the tea." The party loses its generous and magnificent character in such circumstances. It is one more chore. The accessories that make up a party are only a source of worry. You have to check the crystal and the tablecloth, measure the champagne and pettifours. A broken cup, the silk upholstering of a burned armchair, are a disaster. Tomorrow you have to clean, put away, put in order. The woman dreads this extra work. She feels this multiple dependence that defines the housewife's destiny. She is dependent on the soufflé, the roast, the butcher, the cook, the extra help. She is dependent on the husband, who frowns every time something goes wrong. She is dependent on the guests, who judge the furniture and wine and who decide if the evening has been a success or not. Only generous or self-confident women will go through this ordeal with a light heart. A triumph can give them a heady satisfaction, but in this respect, many resemble Mrs. Dalloway, about whom Wolfe tells us, "Although she loved these triumphs and their brilliance and the excitement they brought, she also felt the hollowness, the sham. The woman can only take pleasure in it if she does not attach too much importance to it. If she does, she will be tormented by a perpetually unsatisfied vanity. Besides, few women are wealthy enough to find their life's occupation in socializing. Those who devote themselves to it entirely usually try not only to make a cult of it, but also to go beyond this social life toward other aims. Genuine salons have a literary or political side. These women try to influence men and to play a personal role. They escape from the condition of the married woman. She is not usually fulfilled by the pleasures and ephemeral triumphs rarely bestowed on her, and that often mean as much fatigue as distraction. Social life demands that woman represent that she show off, but does not create between her and others real communication. It does not wrest her from her solitude. It is painful to think, writes Michelet, that woman, the relative being who can only live in a couple, is more often alone than man. He finds social life everywhere, makes new contacts. As for her, she is nothing without her family, and the family weighs her down. All weight is on her. And in fact, the woman kept confined, isolated, does not have the joys of a comradeship that involves pursuing aims together. Her work does not occupy her mind. Her education did not give her either the taste or the habit of independence. And yet, she spends her days in solitude. We have seen that this is one of the miseries Sophia Tolstoy complained of. Her marriage often took her away from her father's home and the friends of her youth. In Mes Apprentissages, My Apprenticeships, Colette described the uprooting of a bride transported from her province to Paris. Only the long correspondence she exchanged with her mother provided any relief. But letters are no substitute for presents, and she cannot admit her disappointments to Sidot. Often, there is no longer any real closeness between the young woman and her family. Neither her mother nor her sisters are her friends. Nowadays, due to a housing crisis, many young couples live with their families or in-laws. But this enforced presence is far from ever providing real companionship for the young woman. The feminine friendships she is able to keep or make are precious for a woman. They are very different from relations men have. Men relate to each other as individuals through their ideas, their own personal projects. Women, confined within the generality of their destiny as women, are united by a kind of imminent complicity. And what they seek first of all from each other is the affirmation of their common universe. They do not discuss opinions. They exchange confidences and recipes. They join together to create a kind of counter-universe whose values outweigh male values. When they meet, they find the strength to shake off their chains. They negate male sexual domination by confiding their frigidity to each other and cynically deriding the appetites or the clumsiness of their males. They also contest with irony the moral and intellectual superiority of their husbands and men in general. They compare their experiences, pregnancies, deliveries, children's illnesses, their own illnesses, and housework become the essential events of human history. Their work is not technical. In transmitting recipes for cooking or housework, they give them the dignity of a secret science founded in oral traditions. Sometimes they examine moral problems together. Letters to the editor in women's magazines are a good example of these exchanges. We can hardly imagine a Lonely Hearts column reserved for men. They meet in the world, which is their world, whereas women must define, measure, and explore their own space. Mostly, they share beauty tips or cooking or knitting recipes, and they ask each other for advice. Real anxieties can sometimes be perceived in women's tendency to talk and show off. The woman knows the male code is not hers. That man even expects she will not observe it, since he pushes her to abortion, adultery, misdeeds, betrayal, and lies he officially condemns. She then asks other women to help her to define a sort of parallel law, a specifically feminine moral code. It is not only out of malevolence that women comment on and criticize the conduct of their girlfriends so much. To judge them and to lead their own lives, they need much more moral invention than men. What makes these relationships valuable is their truthfulness. When confronting man, woman is always on stage. She lies when pretending to accept herself as the inessential other. She lies when she presents to him an imaginary personage through impersonations, clothes, and catchphrases. This act demands constant tension. Every woman thinks more or less, "I am not myself," around her husband or her lover. The male world is hard. There are sharp angles, voices are too loud, lights are too bright, contacts brusque. When with other women, the wife is backstage. She sharpens her weapons. She does not enter combat. She plans her clothes, devises makeup, prepares her ruses. She lies around in slippers and robe in the wings before going on stage. She likes this lukewarm, soft, relaxed atmosphere. Colette describes the moments she spends with her girlfriend Marco like this. Brief confidences, the amusements of two women shut away from the world. Hours that were now like those in a sewing room, now like the idle ones of convalescence. Note, le képi, the képi. She enjoys playing the advisor to the older woman. As we sat under the balcony awning on those hot afternoons, Marco mended her underclothes. She sewed badly, but conscientiously, and I flattered my vanity by giving her pieces of advice such as, "You're using too coarse a thread for fine needles. You shouldn't put blue baby ribbon in chemises. Pink is much prettier in lingerie and up against the skin." It was not long before I gave her others, concerning her face powder, the color of her lipstick, a hard line she penciled around the edge of her beautifully shaped eyelids. "Do you think so? Do you think so?" she would say. My youthful authority was adamant. I took the comb. I made a charming little gap in her tight, sponge-like fringe. I proved expert at softly shadowing her eyes and putting a faint pink glow high up on her cheekbones, near her temples. A bit further on, she shows us Marco anxiously preparing to face a young man she wants to win over. She was about to wipe her wet eyes, but I stopped her. "Let me do it, Marco." With my two thumbs, I raised her upper eyelids so that the two tears about to fall should be reabsorbed and not smudge the mascara on her lashes by wetting them. "There, wait, I haven't finished." I retouched all her features. Her mouth was trembling a little. She submitted patiently, sighing as if I were dressing a wound. To complete everything, I filled the puff in her handbag with a rosier shade of powder. Neither of us uttered a word meanwhile. "Whatever happens," I told her, "don't cry. At all costs, don't let yourself give way to tears." She pressed her hand to her forehead, under her fringe. "I ought to have bought that black dress last Saturday, the one I saw in the secondhand shop. Tell me, could you possibly lend me some very fine stockings? I've left it too late now to—" "Yes, yes, of course. Thank you. Don't you think a flower to brighten up my dress? No, not a flower on the bodice. Is it true that iris is a scent that's gone out of fashion? I'm sure I had heaps of other things to ask you, heaps of things." And in still another of her books, Le Toutounier, Colette evoked this other side of women's life. Three sisters, unhappy or troubled in their loves, gather every night around the old sofa from their childhood. There they relax, pondering the worries of the day, preparing tomorrow's battles, tasting the ephemeral pleasures of a reparative rest, a good sleep, a warm bath, a crying session. They barely speak, but each one creates a nesting space for the others, and everything taking place with them is real. For some women, this frivolous and warm intimacy is more precious than the serious pomp of their relations with men. It is in another woman that the narcissist, as in the days of her adolescence, sees a favorite double. It is through her attentive and competent eyes that she can admire her well-cut dress, her elegant interior. Over and above marriage, the best friend remains her favorite witness. She can still continue to be a desirable and desired object. In almost every young girl, as we have seen, there are homosexual tendencies. The often awkward embraces of her husband do not efface these tendencies. This is the source of the sensual softness woman feels for her counterparts, and that has no equal in ordinary men. Sensual attachment between two women friends can be sublimated into exalted sentimentality or expressed in diffuse or real caresses. Their embraces can also be no more than a distracting pastime. Such is the case for harem women whose principal concern is to kill time, or they can become of primary importance. It is nonetheless rare for feminine complicity to reach true friendship. Women feel more spontaneous solidarity with each other than men do, but from within this solidarity, they do not transcend toward each other. Together they are turned toward the masculine world, whose values each hopes to monopolize for herself. Their relations are not built on their singularity, but are lived immediately in their generality, and from there, the element of hostility comes into play. Natasha, who cherished the women in her family because they could witness the births of her babies, nevertheless felt jealous of them. Every one of them could embody the woman in Pierre's eyes. Note, Tolstoy, War and Peace. Women's mutual understanding lies in the fact that they identify with each other, but then each one competes with her companion. A housewife has a more intimate relationship with her maid than a man, unless he is homosexual, has with his valet or chauffeur. They tell each other secrets, and sometimes they are accomplices. But there are also hostile rivalries between them, because while freeing herself from the actual work, the mistress of the house wants to assume the responsibility and credit for the work she assigns. She wants to think of herself as irreplaceable, indispensable. Everything goes wrong as soon as I'm not there. She harasses her maid in order to find fault with her. If she does her job too well, the mistress cannot be proud of feeling unique. Likewise, she systematically becomes irritated with teachers, governesses, nurses, and children's maids who care for her offspring, with parents and friends who help her out. She gives the excuse that they do not respect her will, that they do not carry out her ideas. The truth is that she has neither particular will nor ideas. What irritates her, on the contrary, is that others carry out her functions exactly as she would. This is one of the main sources of family and domestic discussions that poison the life of the home. The less able she is to show her own merits, the fiercer she is in wanting to be sovereign. But where women especially see each other as enemies is in the area of seduction and love. I have pointed out this rivalry in girls. It often continues throughout life. We have seen how they seek absolute validation in the ideal of the fashionable woman or the socialite. She suffers from not being surrounded by glory. She cannot bear to perceive the slightest halo around someone else.